In February 2013, the arch-conservative Pope Benedict made a startling announcement. He would resign, making him the first pope to willingly vacate his office in over 700 years. Reeling from the news, the College of Cardinals rushed to Rome to congregate in the Sistine Chapel to pick his successor. Their unlikely choice, Francis, the first non-European pope in 1,200 years, a one-time tango club bouncer, a passionate soccer fan, a man with a common touch. Why did Benedict walk away at the height of his power, knowing his successor might be someone whose views might undo his legacy? Having immersed himself in these men's lives to write the screenplay for the upcoming motion picture, The Pope, Andrew McCartan now weaves the stories into a gripping narrative for The Pope, The Book, which is soon to be a film starring Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce. Anthony McCartan is a novelist, playwright, TV writer, and filmmaker. He is a two-time Academy Award-nominated screenwriter for writing the biographical films The Theory of Everything and The Darkest Hour. He most recently wrote the film Bohemian Rhapsody, which has been nominated for an Oscar for this year's Best Picture. Then it's a great pleasure to welcome Anthony McCartan to the program. So how did you get onto this this train, if you will, of thinking that this would be a story that you want to tell?
Well, firstly, it was kind of by accident. I happened to be in Rome and received a text message from my sister telling me the distressing news that a cousin of mine had just died, and she said, if you're near a church, go and light a candle. And being in Rome, there was plenty of churches to choose from. But I thought, well, I'll go right to the source. So my girlfriend Eva and I, we decided to go to St. Peter's itself. But when we arrived at the great square of St. Peter, there was high security, and we wondered what it was for. But once we got inside, we realized what it was. Pope Francis was up on a super screen. He was delivering an open-air mass to the faithful. I don't know, there must have been 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people clustered in there. And there was a sort of ambience that you associate with a kind of rock concert. And being, in my late 50s, I've seen, various popes before, but there's something new about this guy. And Eva, who's German, I asked her, where is the other pope? Because there's two popes now, right? And she confirmed, yeah. And she even knew that there was a place behind the Vatican where Benedict, the retired, resigned pope, was now living in a sort of cloistered convent. And I asked her, how many years has it been since there were two popes living? Almost within a stone's throw of each other, and she didn't know, but we Googled it, and it was 700 years since there's been two popes, right. Which got me sort of asking the question, what went on here? What made this huge breach of tradition that dates so far back in history? What were the forces that conspired to make it happen? And that was the start of the book and the movie.
Now, one of the questions that you ask in the book, which I have read and I have not seen the movie, but it is one of the main things that you explore is why did Pope Benedict, at seemingly the height of his power, leave, knowing that his successor, Francis, may very well be and time has shown that he has been a person who would ultimately look to undo his legacy.
Well, that's indeed the question that sort of fascinated me, because if Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict, was anything, he was an arch-conservative who had set his store by being a bulwark against change. He was a representative of tradition and of continuity with John Paul, who, although John Paul had been a sort of pop star pope, he was also very conservative on issues like abortion, homosexuality, contraception, and that those policies were enforced by Pope Benedict. And so the question in my mind was, why would the most traditional pope of the modern era do the most untraditional thing and resign? And so based on the intuition that there must have been forces that no one was admitting, at work on him. I went to work, and adding to the sort of fascination with that resignation was, as you say, it was most likely that his successor would be Cardinal Bergoglio from Argentina, because for no other reason that Bergoglio had come second to Ratzinger in the election, the conclave that had elected Benedict. So not only was it fascinating from a psychological point of view why a conservative would do a very unconservative, untraditional thing, but why he would do so with the knowledge that it would probably give way to a period of massive reform, which is starting, hopefully, to happen.
When you talk about reform, obviously, the elephant in the room always, unfortunately, is the incredible sexual abuse crisis and the trauma of that plagued the church for decades and decades. Do you believe that had an effect on the resignation?
My sense, having dived into as much research as I've done, is that it must have. I think it's psychologically untenable to say that the resignation simply came about because he was feeling old and not up to the task. All popes at some point are old and not up to the task. And it's almost one of the defining qualities of being a pope. What sets them apart is that they die on the job. As I say, Christ did not come down from his cross. And there's some sort of incredible authority that comes from the suffering, the almost Christ-like, Calvary-like suffering that popes endure at the end of their lives. And it's almost necessary that they do so, because if they're just to do their term and retire, what then sets them apart? What makes them sacred? They're just like any politician doing a term. The resignation of Benedict has massive ramifications, theological and social.
And what is your knowledge through the research and just the hunch, if you will, of the relationship between the two men?
They they're chalk and cheese in so many ways. And you've got Benedict, who is a sort of son of a policeman, very conservative, an enforcer of orthodoxy. Wears a Rolex, something of a dandy in terms of his famously red slippers that he wore. And then you contrast that with Francis, who was an ex-nightclub bouncer in a tango club in Argentina, had a girlfriend, proposed marriage, loves music, loves humor. So they're very, very different men. But they have, however, on the surface of it, all these huge differences. But in as I did more and more research, I saw similarities in that both of them had come through totalitarian regimes and sort of learned the value of secrecy, acquired the habit of secrecy, if you like, when in terrifying times it could cost lives if you spoke out. So they fitted very neatly within the culture of secrecy that the Catholic Church is famous for. And the challenge of these times is that we need a pope that can actually break with that tradition and introduce a new era of transparency and honesty and reconciliation.
You have a chapter in the book titled "The Superstar Pope." How much of that superstar quality of Pope Francis do you think is genuinely aimed at him and what he has done and what he has said, and how much of it is maybe that, but also being such a polar opposite to his predecessor?
I think it's justified. There was a tremendous cry for change you know, after years and years of retrenchment and conservativeness and basically making the church incredibly insular, and I would say almost irrelevant in the lives, you know, to modern lives as we live them, especially in the West, which I think accounts for the massive decline in numbers of people interested in, you know, showing up in a church on Sunday. But, you know, he's the first South American in 1,200 years that that's ever come to the job, and he's an astonishing sort of ad libber and reformer, and a breath of entirely fresh air. You know, the universal refrain when he takes, you know, steps in front of a microphone is, "What's he going to say now?" There's a touch of the John Lennon about him. But in fact, both men have been on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. And so the question is, does he deserve this kind of, you know, characterization? And I would say yes, because for a church which never seems to, utter anything which is basically reformist, to have a pope say something that homosexuals are God made, and he, as he told one man, and a homosexual, Juan Carlos Cruz, who was speaking to, and who had been a victim of sexual abuse, he said, "God made you like this and loves you like this, and I don't care." I mean, that is enormously transformational thing for a pope to say. What I was impressed by also is that on topics like the literal truth of the Bible, he called Adam and Eve a fable. I think it's absolutely essential that someone comes out and says that. For a pope to say it is pretty extraordinary. He's been very, very strong on capitalism. He calls it trickle-down suffering. He's very big on the environment, and issued a encyclical just on Mother Earth and what we can do about it. And his next big challenge, even though he's aging now, is to really deal with the sex abuse scandal and put in place a mechanism whereby this thing can be done properly. It's an awful, awful handling of it by Ratzinger, who really was not the man for the job, and buried his head in the sand for far too long. And the sense of rage that built up around the world, quite rightly, is a mess that Francis has sort of inherited. And hopefully now, you know, it's finally putting a red line under all that.
It does seem, though, that if there has been any repudiation against the superstar pope, it has been even some of the missteps in handling that crisis, which I wonder if, you know, if you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, no matter what you do in that situation.
Yeah, I really think that, I mean, as I said earlier, both of them came out of totalitarian regimes, Pinochet in Argentina and Nazism in Germany, and then when you're then raised in a church which is deeply, deeply bound by a culture of secrecy, it's very then hard to then, you know, have a completely new strategy to that. So yes, very, very slow. Infuriatingly slow in dealing with this scandal, but eventually I think Francis now realizes the dimensions of it all and has just called a massive convention of cardinals and bishops to put in place a way of dealing with this with total transparency and zero tolerance for perpetrators.
Let me end by just talking about your life as a screenwriter for a moment. I can't even imagine in such a relatively short period of time, you have dedicated your life to the lives of Winston Churchill, the two popes, and Freddie Mercury. That by all
it's
measures...
A pretty natural triumvirate.
Yes. I mean, that is certainly, that is varied.
Yeah.
Is that conscious?
Perhaps. I mean, all our characters who were under enormous pressure to step up and do something astonishing, and all in their own way have have achieved it and are trying to achieve it. So I'm, you know, great lives well lived always attracts me. And finding, you know, the psychology, the new, unique human frail side of those supposedly great people is what really gets me up in the morning, because we are all 99% alike. And it's finding that little quality inside yourself that becomes truly excellent. I think that's a universal message that's inspiring.
Congratulations on the Oscar nominations for Bohemian Rhapsody.
Thank you very much.
It must be thrilling to see that.
Yes, it's probably, you know, garnered the worst reviews of my life, and but it's made its own case through the court of public opinion. It's quite nice to see, you know, the final verdict wrested away from critics and, you know, put in the hands of the public. And it's done extremely well. And, you know, I'm delighted because Freddie Mercury is just a wonderful human being, and that the story has reached into so many cultures, and, you know, around the world. And, you know, there's a sing-along happening right now in Tokyo and in South Korea, and everybody dressed up with mustaches and so forth. It's amazing the sort of penetration that you get with a movie. It really is the art form of the present. So I'm very, very grateful.
Anthony McCartan's work includes Bohemian Rhapsody, Darkest Hour, The Theory of Everything. The new book is The Pope, Francis Benedict, and the Decision That Shook the World. The movie is coming out with Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, and we will expect to see that when?
There's no announcement yet. It's a Netflix movie who released Roma, they're keeping it a little under wraps what their plans are, but I would imagine sometime around October, November.
Terrific. Again, the new book is The Pope. It is out by Flatiron Books. Anthony McCartan, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
And thank you, an honor. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Pope, published by Flatiron. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.